My name is Clancy Immersland. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clancy!
You like that, Beverly. It frightens me. Well, I must say, I want to congratulate Pat. He asked me this morning how he should introduce me. And I had an idea. I said, how about once in a thousand years a man is something. And it really went quite well, brought tears to my own eyes. And he was trying to memorize that because he never would. So I said, okay, just tell him I'm active in sponsorship and active in my home group, because that's really the correct introduction for any AA. You remember that, though, didn't you? I want to really thank Pat. Pat has been an exemplary host. I'm hosted a lot every year in a lot of places. And Pat's as good a host as I've had. And he, from the moment I came down the stairs at the airport and saw that smiling face, and off we went, and he knew where we were going, and he had my room set up, and I told him some things I needed in my room, and he had them in my room. In fact, he went out there earlier in the day and discovered they weren't there and make sure they got them in there. And whenever I told him I want to come back to the meeting, at that time he wheels up in his car and I come out the door. It's just like clockwork. And I just now, I didn't have any money for the basket, so I got some money from him. If I lived up here, kid, you'd be poor. But really, very good. Thank you, Pat. Very good. And I've really enjoyed it here. It's very nice here. It's a wonderful place. I like Billings. I like John Scott and his pocket of enthusiasm that he's infused here. But there's one little thing you're missing that Helena offers. I'm sorry to tell you that. I was at Helena a few months ago, and this city doesn't look any better, and the people there are probably so-so, but they took me outside of Helena, and we visited Clancy, Montana. It was like going to heaven. I ran from the Clancy store to the Clancy library to the Clancy house. Toto was right under my arm. So until you get something like that going, you're nothing. But shall we talk about those pockets of enthusiasm? That phrase, I think, came about many years ago. I was talking in Salina, Kansas, and Dick was there, Dick Martin. And I was trying to describe what happens in some groups, that they get doing things. Doing things like Beverly was talking about. Incidentally, Beverly, I was so pleased that you thanked your host, you thanked Jimmy, you thanked everybody. The only person you forgot. I told Lois Wilson that time. I said, Lois, well, I forget what I told her now. But that's the trouble with being old. I've been up here several times over the years, you know. And I've grown old and gray coming to Montana. And this year, the first time I'm able to say, this probably is the first time you've ever had an octogenarian speaker. That was not easy to get to. It's not so bad being old when I feel good. But you know, about 10 years ago, when I turned 70, the doctor put me on iron tablets. I've been taking iron tablets for 10 years for my blood. I guess that's what it's for. And then recently, I don't tell you why I did this, but I was reading some advertising, and I tried my first Viagra. And I didn't know that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now every 6 hours I face north. I got off the subject. I said, oh, well, the hell with it. I was talking about, and it's talking to Salina, Kansas, and I was trying to grope to find a phrase for a group that's lively and does things. Like Beverly said, hop in cars and go off to places and do things. And I was trying to find the phrase that it was a pocket of enthusiasm. And Dick wrote it down and said, God, that's a great idea. And he went back and started a pocket of enthusiasm conference. And there's been several of them founded. And I always hope there'll be maybe just a little honorarium for the guy who created the word, but there never is. But it's really true, because the pockets of enthusiasm will keep, that's what gives you hope at AA. Because there are spots in AA you go to, you figure God's going to die out in 10 years. They sit around, they're all on, half of them on drugs, and I'm not really an alcoholic, man, I'm just cool. She is, you know. And you, they will do nothing, go nowhere, do anything. But once in a while you come upon a little town or a city, there's a pocket of enthusiasm. There are people excited and doing things and taking the steps. And then you find another 500 miles of, well, I went to my counselor and he said I had to come to a meeting this month. And so you just want to... I'll tell you something funny. Everywhere you find a pocket of enthusiasm, you will find a strong sponsorship ethic. That is always the root underneath it. And the reason for that is, with a strong sponsorship ethic, people are in and are driven to do things, partially by the sponsor, partially by peer pressure. And they get, when you get involved and do the things, you feel better, you get excited, and you like things. Whereas if you hover on the fringe, as many of us have done sometimes, you never get anywhere. Nothing in AA is worth anything. It's just a series of words. Because the last day I drank, I stood in a street corner in Los Angeles. My front teeth kicked out. Everything I had gone. My life behind me. And I knew just about as much about AA then as I do now. Because I've been going to meetings for 10 years, listening to these boobs talk. And I did not qualify. Because for a couple of reasons. If you're new tonight, you may wonder what an alcoholic is. Need any great brains to discover that. An alcoholic, as I always knew, is a person whose problem is alcohol. They come to AA and admit their problem is alcohol. They then return to God and they help others and they live happily. And none of those things fit my case. Because my problem wasn't alcohol. I used to wish it were. I wished it were. Because I'd sit in these AA meetings, I would go to AA meetings to take the heat off after a while. I realized it had no application to me, but to outside people, it looked as though you're trying to do something for yourself. And you could get home. I remember in my early days coming home and telling my wife, well, I've gone back to AA. Wonderful. That's wonderful. It'll help you. I know it will, darling. What do they want you to do? Well, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for any slipper, anywhere, anytime. No, they don't want you to taper off. It's to stop entirely. We have the same steps you do. We understand the program. It's absolute not drinking. I release you, you son of a bitch. But I went to AA a lot and sat in those meetings. And my memory of AA in the early days, I'm sure, I don't know if I ever heard this or not, but it just seemed to me every meeting was a variation of some old fool saying something like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years, night and day. And one day I walked through that door and they told me to put the plug in the jug. And I did. And it's just I've never been so goddamn happy. Adios, muchacho. And it seemed to me as I look back, my life was a series of crises. It's kind of nice to be in Montana because there's a lot of Lutheran churches here, Norwegian Lutheran churches. I was raised in northern Wisconsin, the same kind of weather. I seem to have lost my tolerance for it. Jesus Christ. But I was in Oslo speaking a couple years ago. It made me laugh. Because after the meeting, they took me up to Gudbrandsdalen, which is a big state of Norway, where my grandparents came from. There's still, you find little signs there, Imeslin store and things like that. It's the only place there is. And turned out the 1880s, a whole bunch of Norwegians, young Norwegians, came to America to get away from that damn climate. And they all settled in North Dakota and Montana and Wisconsin. Spend the rest of their life saying, Jesus, it's cold here too. And I was raised in this climate. I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, which was a strict church. And it was a... I had a little problem because I seemed to need more fun than some of the other Lutheran boys. But I did a good job. I was confirmed and catechized, and I could sing little songs in Norwegian. And very strict church, very well-organized, structured. I flourished in it. And in my family-structured life, we'd get together at Christmas, everybody would come from all over and have a... To this day, when I smell a guitar, I mean a cigar, guitar. When I smell a cigar, haven't you ever seen an old man screw up before? Now, where did I leave off? Oh, yes. I was up in northern Norway. Well, I should tell you one other story, too, as long as we're here. A few years ago, I was asked to come and speak in Iceland, Reykjavik, which is full of the descendants of old Norwegians who came to live there 1,000 years ago. And it really is all old Norwegians. And but they have a good group there, a lively group of alcoholics. But it's hell getting there, because you have to go to Minneapolis and go to an Air Iceland, which is like... taking a stagecoach to Iceland and then come back. And I came back on Sunday night and I was tired, this long trip, and I was kind of cold. And I was sitting in Minneapolis in the airport waiting for the plane to Los Angeles. I had about 4 hours to wait. And I sat in the red carpet room, which is the United Airlines frequent flyer room. And I went into the washroom. I had to go to the can, and there are two little stalls side by side, little doors, and just clean and neat. There were no bad odors. And I sat in one of them contemplating life, and all of a sudden from the other stall, this voice said, "Hi there." I thought, can't talk to me. And then the voice said, "What are you doing tonight?" I thought, well, this is ridiculous. I said, I'm going back to Los Angeles to be with my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, but thank you very much for asking. Thank you a lot. There was a long pause, and the voice said, "We could really have some fun tonight if you wanted to." And I was tired. I overreacted. I got almost white hot. Well, that was you got white hot. And I said, "Look, I don't know what your problem is, pal, but I'm not in here to chat with you. Now get off it." There's a long pause, and the voice said, "I'll have to call you back. This asshole in the next stall won't shut up." Might be funny to you, it wasn't funny to me. But I grew up in it seemed to be my life is a series of I look back over today, kind of a series of traumas. My first trauma was when I was about 11 years old, my parents got divorced. That doesn't sound like much, does it? But can you imagine? I had never heard of a divorce at 11 years old. Nobody in our church ever had one, nobody in our family ever had. Someone explained it to me later, and I knew what it was. But it just, and I was doing very well. I'd been shoved ahead a year and a half in school. I was getting straight A's. I was doing great. And without even being aware of it, I did the worst possible thing I could have done. I've always had a flair for doing the wrong thing. I've had been trained to do the right thing, but I do the wrong thing because I have a flair. And that flair in this case was playing my mother against my father to avoid discipline. And my mother gave me hell, I'd run to my father. My father gave me hell, I'd run to my mother. Both gave me hell, I'd run to my grandma. And I fooled them again and again and again and again. And by the time I was 15, I'd fooled them completely. Except I was flunking out of high school. I had no friends anymore because I'd withdrawn behind cynical, snotty little remarks all the time that alienated people. I didn't have any, didn't like anything. And I really was on the way to something bad, I'll tell you. Because I was starting to chum around with people who were going to the reformatory and prisons and things. And what saved my life was the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. And I got interested in the Second World War. And whenever I get a dime, I'd go to the show. And but when I was 15, I thought, that's what I really should do. If I ran away, because there was a kid that I've been in school with, he came home and he had a Marine Corps uniform on, dressed with it. That's what I need. I could really be something then. So I decided to... And I got a guy to give me a ride to Minneapolis, and another guy gave me a ride from Minneapolis to San Francisco. And he was in the Navy going back to a ship or something. And I told him I wanted to be in the service, be in the Marine Corps. And I had about this big and a face full of pimples. And he said, you probably can't get in the Marine Corps. You're pretty small. And you might get the Merchant Marines. They'll take almost anybody that's breathing now because so many guys have gone to the Navy. But don't tell him you're 15, tell him you're 16. He dropped me off at this office in San Francisco, and I went in. Guys, I said, I want to be in the Merchant Marine. I put down 16. He said, well, you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. They're just crying for people, and they issued me temporary Seaman's papers, sent me permanent ones later. That afternoon, I went down to the National Maritime Union with another guy that took us down there. Took us to the Embarcadero, put us on a ship. That afternoon, we're on our way to the South Pacific. And all the memories of everything happened in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, went away. Started a whole new area, but I mean, on that ship, I mean, it was, you know, these guys were the scum of the earth. I mean, couldn't get in the Navy, couldn't get nothing. Just, ha, 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 ha. We've been pirates anywhere, the other generation. And... one of these guys, I believe this happened, one of these guys had a hook like an old pirate's, and he had a patch in his eye. I said, what happened to your hand? He said, I got in a fight with a guy in a bar, cut off my hand, but I killed him. Oh, what happened to your eye? Said, well, I was checking the weather, and the bird flew over and crapped in my eye. And he lifted it up, and there was a big hole full of pus. I said, oh, my God, how could a bird crap do that? No, it didn't. It happened to be the first day I had my hook. Well, maybe that didn't happen. I don't know. It's all dim. But the important thing that happened to me on that ship was I had my first drink of whiskey. I never planned to drink whiskey, but these guys kind of nagged me into it. Come on, you little punk, have a drink of whiskey. So I had a drink of whiskey, and I threw it up, and they laughed at me. And to this day, I don't know an emotion worse than public humiliation. But you just look like it's nothing, and everybody knows you're a nothing, and you can't disguise it. I wanted to just hit these guys, and I couldn't. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard. It would have been cute. I could have said, lean over, you. Yeah. Take that. Just... But I kept trying to drink out of those guys' bottle when nobody was around, and we were coming into Pearl Harbor finally. They're still digging up ships. It was the night before my 16th birthday. I remember that. I took a drink of whiskey, and it stayed down. Made me kind of sick, but it stayed down. And a minute or two later, I felt significantly better. And I discovered something that... I wouldn't have the sense to know it then, but in retrospect, I suppose maybe I had some innate sense. But, you're supposed to go through life kind of feeling like this. Pretty even inside, ups and downs. And it seemed to me I always felt like this, for one reason or another, especially in those later years. And I always thought, well, I got to do something about it. But one thing, in looking back, what alcohol did for me, it got rid of the scale. And it did that for the rest of my drinking life. I didn't even know it. I had no insights at all like I have today. I just know it made me feel better when I felt bad, that's all. And I thought, when I grow up, I'm going to be something. And When I grew up, later in the war, I went in the Navy when I got old enough. And at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital up in San Francisco being sewed together. And they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests, so they gave me a high school diploma because I'm still a junior in high school. And I went back to Wisconsin after the war and went to the university and won some trophies for the university and had a second big trauma there. That was the second big trauma of my life, I think. In my senior year, I was drinking quite a lot. We were veterans, and we drank and raised hell and did a lot of things. And I'd won some trophies, and I could get by with things. And at the end of the year, I had missed an English history. First of all, I was signed up to teach journalism at Duluth-Denfeld High School. That's where I was going to go. And at the end of the year, I was drinking a lot, and I missed the early morning class English history. The old bag in there gave me an incomplete, which you should have done. But on graduation day, I spoke at the commencement. I spoke on behalf of the senior class, and I got my diploma. It was blank, however, because I needed to complete those things. And I had to go to summer school to finish it off, one class. And I got a job at U.S. Rubber Company balancing white sidewall tires. I went to my one class every day and drank a lot at night and had fun and raised hell. One night I was feeling pensive and sad, and I was sitting in the bar, and this pretty girl came in, and I got talking to her. I told her what they'd done to me at this stinking university, how they'd hurt me. And she had turned out to be a magazine salesman, traveling magazine salesman, but she was there with somebody. And she said, "I don't really think you won all those trophies, did you? Is that yours? Are you trying to get..." I said, "Come on." We went down to the university, and it was late at midnight. And I kicked the glass out of a door, and we went in and to the trophy case, and there was my picture and the trophies. And she was, I think, overcome by it. And she, as I recall, she slumped to the floor. I thought she'd had a flat, and I was trying to pump her up there. And all of a sudden, a policeman's flashlight illuminated. If you ever want to find passion, stop quickly. And they took me downtown and arrested me, because in those years it was kind of serious. They took her downtown, arrested her. The next morning I went to court, and before I went to judge, I got a letter from the chancellor of the university saying, "I've tried to cover for you again and again. I've tried every in my power. All you had to do was stay straight for another 2 weeks, but you're expelled and don't ever come back on the campus." I got a telegram from Duluth saying, "Your job has been canceled because of moral turpitude." And I was in this judge. I remember this Judge Farr. He said something that sounded so stupid to me. I was reading this. "Oh, Judge, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." He said, "Clancy, I'm afraid you're too sorry." I said, "Why would you say that?" He said, "Because when you're that sorry, you're not only sorry you've done something, but you kind of secretly know you'll do it again." I thought, what a stupid thing, but boy, how true that is. Not that specific thing, but do something. And so I had to give up my teaching career, and I got a little job as a sports writer on a paper and started a new career. And little by little, it went along. And I married to a late girl, and we had some children, and I worked in some places. And I got a pretty good job in the advertising department of Fairbanks Morse. And I was drinking a lot, so they finally called me in and said, "You know, you're missing Mondays. You're doing a good job, but we can't have you working like this." And so I happen to remember I'd visited Eau Claire, a DAA club there, briefly when I was trying to impress the judge. And I thought, I had a great idea. I told the guy, I said, "Mr. Carlson, you're right. I got drinking overseas, you know, and I don't want to talk about the horrors of it." I said, "Would you mind if I'd go to this? Got this new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and get rid of my drinking. Give me a couple of weeks. Would you do that?" "Oh, yes. You're well worth the investment." And I went there, same old baloney, and turn your life over to God and things like that. Nonsense. But one thing it did, it gave me time to look for a new job. And I did that again and again and again for years. When the heat was on, I'd go to AA. I couldn't wait to get out of there and get away from these simpletons and their idiots and their little slogans and their phrases and their stories. And after gag a maggot, just terrible, on and on. But I used to sit there sometimes, I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish my problem were alcohol. But I knew it wasn't, very simply. because alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. And I drink alcohol for my problem. How do you explain that to anybody? You know, they say alcoholics can't stop. I can, all my whole drinking career, I can stop. I can stop a lot of times, many times, for good reasons. Never had any problem with it. My problem is after I stop, in the next day or 2 days or 3 days or sometime later, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And how it comes out, not that I need drink, it comes out as just a little restlessness, a little irritability, a little tired of listening to the sermon from what I did last time. Get off it! It's over. And little by little watch whatever technicolor there is in the world slowly turn into black and white again. And the tediousness of seeing the stuff you're into, the goofs you're working with, and it gets bad. And I've tried. I made some pretty good money for a while because I became a good writer, and I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to beat that emotion. I spent thousands of dollars, and I read books, and I got in cults, and I got around people I hated just because I thought they had some answer. But the best answer ever to that problem, just have a couple drinks. Well, you know, we have tests here for alcoholism. 20 questions, 40 questions in the East, some different things. But I have a question. I have a test. I'd like to give it somebody. I'm sure it'll work. Take somebody that you believe to be an alcoholic and get them off everything and keep them dry for a week. Then give them a big drink. Here. And if he goes, because boy, it really does it. And the only problem I ever have is sometimes I drink too much. And as my psychiatrist pointed out to me, many times I've been thoughtlessly overserved. And I've done a lot of things. I'm desperately trying to do well. You know, one of the things that happened to me in the psychiatric world as I was going through that is something that happened I see happening to people around me now. I'll tell you, I didn't know what it was, but I liked psychoanalysis. I'd leave there and I'd be feeling better. It was just good. I didn't know why. I just felt good. We talked about bad things, but they made me feel good. And many years later, maybe 25 years ago, some guy I sponsored came and told me he belonged to a new organization called Adult Children of Alcoholics. I said, what the hell is that? He said, it's a group of people trying to work through their problems. And would you like to go to a couple of meetings? And I said, sure. So I went to a couple of meetings with him. And right in the middle of the meeting, suddenly struck me. God, they're doing the same thing that psychiatrists did for me. They're removing their problems. The number one problem of people that I know of is guilt. Deep-seated guilt. Things I did. And even worse, things I didn't do. I should have done, if only I had before she died. And all the guilt. And it's like a steady gold ball in your stomach. Wouldn't it be nice if you could? There's nothing that I know of gets rid of guilt. Drinking does. Drinking gets rid of everything for a while. But I never found any reading or any meeting that would get rid of guilt. But in psychoanalysis, in looking back, I could see what made me feel better. I was getting rid of guilt. And how they made me get rid of guilt was this. They were showing me how again and again I had been hurt in my life by others. My problems weren't my fault. It was their fault. It was, in their case, the alcoholic parents. But in my case, it was everybody that misunderstood me. And little by little, as you fasten guilt over there, it comes out of you. Because it's not my fault. I've been made this way. God, you can't blame me. I'm sorry. I just hate it. And it's really great. You say, what's wrong with that? To get rid of guilt. And it's great. Except you've come to AA eventually, and you read this book and stay around here a while, you'll discover that the little price tags you pay for victimization are lethal. What are the little price tags you pay for victimization? Well, you must accept the fact, of course, that these people have hurt you, so you have a growing and intense resentment toward the people who failed you. And secondly, you have a little growing knowledge that you've been made different and there's nothing you can do about it. Remember the guy at the meeting talked about, we are like saplings, and when we were young, someone came along and reached within us and took out our heart. We continue to grow into full trees, but we are empty inside because they've taken out our heart. And we'll always be different. And when you get here, you run across something funny. That they say the two worst problems people like us face is resentment and the feelings of difference. Because if they're not treated, must always drink to handle it. And that's what you get out of that. And I know that I didn't stay in it very long because I drank too much, but I know people are in that. I try to ease them out of it. And I know that some people had terrible childhoods and terrible things happened to them. But like Dr. Bob's son said, I don't want to spend the rest of my life playing out the role of a wounded 16-year-old neurotic. Because in AA we discover that was then and this is now. And if you want to play victimization so you can wallow in it, that's fine. But it'll kill you sooner or later. It's such an inviting thing, though, to remember how you've been hurt. And that you've just got to get off that. It's hard to remember. People, parents, other people are all doing the best they know how, I think. And they don't do very well sometimes, but I can't destroy my life because of that. But I tried a lot of things. And I went up and down and up and down, and finally I got to Texas, and I did fairly well there. I worked at an advertising agency in the daytime, and I was on the faculty of the University of Texas at El Paso at night, directing the Grand Opera. Not the music direction, I'm not qualified, but I did the staging and direction. Because I did a lot of that in college, did a lot of community theaters in all the cities I worked in. And it was a great thing. It really became wonderful. And it was over. And then I felt depressed and sad. And I began drinking a lot. I used to have a problem. When I get to a certain level of drinking, I have it necessary to counsel police officers. Jesus, what a dumb thing that is. But when I see injustice, I put on my Captain Justice. Hey, you! Hey, blue belly, son of a bitch! You know. So I spent a lot of nights in jail. I'm no big felon like some of the speakers, but I've been in jail a lot. I got so I could get out in the morning and, I'd take a shower and go to work. I could handle that. One morning I got out of jail I'd been persecuted by some rotten cop. And some guy was waiting for me. He says, gee, you should have been home last night. And I said, I know. But he said, no, well, you're all drunk. Your little son died and we couldn't find you. And I thought, oh, Jesus. Oh, God. I had little girls and one little boy. And he was the apple of my eye. And, God. I almost went crazy. We went to Wisconsin and buried him at the foot of his grandmother's grave. And I took a little vow in his casket when nobody's looking. John Emerson, this will never happen again. I swear to God, this will never happen again. We went back to Texas. And I went back to work at the advertising agency. I started drinking a little bit just because I got sad and lonely sometimes. And I got drunk one night, I think. And I said, well, I can't do this. I promised my dead son I won't do this. And I quit drinking. And I determined to make my life and my children's life a good place. It was almost like Easter. Somebody died, but by God, he died for my sins. And I'd come home at night from work, and my daughters and I would go for a ride, and every meal we had, we said a little prayer for baby John, and we all felt good, and everything was fine, and God's taking him home, and just wonderful. And God brought maybe the best 4 weeks of my life. A big part of things. And then one night somebody snuck into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day it started. Just a little irritability, just a little tiredness. Didn't like that. And it mounted a little bit, and pretty soon a new breakthrough came. I realized this is because of that stinking Norwegian God, because I've committed some sins and he's punishing me. My little boy who never committed a sin is dead because that son of a bitch is killing him to punish me. Well, screw you! And that was the end of my relationship with God. And I never wanted to be around God again. But it just kept going. And pretty soon I didn't want to be in that town anymore. I didn't want to be in that job anymore. Just my children who I was doing it for. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For Christ's sake, let me. I'm sorry, we'll play tomorrow. It got awfully bad. And I need just have a couple of drinks. But when I promised my dead son I wouldn't drink, I can't do anything about that. And one day my wife took the children to church. And I just pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I just didn't know what to do. And a neighbor next door, she happened to be sitting, he was having a cup of coffee in his breakfast nook. He saw me go in there and I heard the motor running. I didn't come out, so he ambled over, see how I was doing. Found me dead in the car. And they pulled me out and they beat on my chest and they breathed my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and examined me for several days and determined I was seriously mentally ill. My reactions were those of a seriously mentally ill person. So I was committed to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period, perhaps the rest of my life. Now that's how I guess when I stopped drinking. That is not really what you call an alcohol problem. When I was in that nut house, it was bad. It was in Big Spring, Texas. I'd never been there. I was there about 2 weeks, and you could hear screams sometimes coming in different places. Oh, Jesus, and terrible places. What the hell am I doing here? I thought, I got to get out of here. He said, but don't try to escape from here. Say, escape from hospital. Okay. And I thought, you big redneck simpleton, I'll be out of here before you know it. It took about a week to find a way to get through a door and across a corridor and through another door and out in the yard and over the fence, and I was gone. And then I just discovered it was an escape-proof hospital after I got out, which sounds odd. But I'd never seen the countryside around there. Around Midland, Texas, or Big Spring, they can see you running for 3 days. And you feel like such a fool in your white bathrobe just a matter of time the field glasses pick you up. Why, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back and gave me a couple months of intensive electric shock treatments for that. And I almost didn't get out of there because my mind didn't almost come back. The next spring, I was still in there coming off these shock treatments. And I noticed something. Somehow or other, somebody in Big Spring, Texas had convinced the Texas authorities to put in an experimental alcoholic ward in that hospital. It later became an all the hospital, but then it was just there. And I thought, my God, AA's, my memories came back. I know what those idiots want. And I lay in wait for the counselor, Mr. Ross. I was the mailman by this time. I was living in the senile ward, peddling mail. And he came. I said, Mr. Ross, I'm here on a commitment from El Paso. And I'm not a psychopath, but my problem has always been alcohol. And it makes me, sometimes just ruins my life. Do you have any kind of book I could read or any literature? Or is there anything I could do to find a new life? Maybe return to my lost God. His eyes went, because everybody on his program had been turned in by their families. At that time, you could, if you had a drinking relative, you could go down and have them put in the hospital for 30 days, the alcoholic ward. And so these people weren't happy in there. You know, you'd say to a guy, what are you going to do when you get out of here, Fred? I'm going to kill that bitch. Yeah. And he said, I'll get back to you, boy. And I never heard from him for 2-3 days. I thought the old fool has burned me off, but turned out he had to go through Austin, and I became the pilot study in the state of Texas whether or not a psychiatric commitment should be in the alcoholic ward. And I went in there, and I just ate their lunch because I knew exactly what they wanted, and they didn't know I knew. And we talked about it this morning. He'd give us a lecture, all of us, an hour on the 12 steps, just like living hell, just doing just. And these guys would say, he'd say, are there any questions, boys? No. Oh, Jesus. Mr. Ross, could you tell us again about the fourth step and the fifth step and how we find this terribleness and get it out of our system and work with the sponsor and find a new life? He said, yes, I can tell you about that, Clancy. And the rest of the room would say, oh, shit. But I didn't care about him, them. I needed him. And pretty soon I get to be the star of that hospital ward, I'll tell you, because they kept coming and going every 30 days, and I was going to be there forever. And they used to take me out to little towns around there, Midland, Odessa, San somewhere it was down south there. And I'd give them the, they'd say, well, we have a real treat tonight. We have a boy from the hospital who's found a new life through the AA program. Clancy. My name is Clancy and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm here on behalf of my fellow patients to thank each and every one of you for bringing a message of hope to us. It's almost as though we were lost on a vast desert of alcoholism. And we came to the tall green hills of sobriety and we could not climb them. But folks such as you pointed out 12 golden steps that we could take. And we would reach that. Sometimes old ladies would cry. And now we're getting used to returning to our homes through West Texas, and we will help others lost on that. We'll find them in the lost desert. We'll say, over here, over here. Here are 12 jobs. And it's only because of the love and kindness of wonderful people such as you. Thank you. And you may laugh that got me out of the Texas Nut House. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But that was a crisis. I came out of there and I got a little job in El Paso where I'd been a big shot kind of, had a little job. And then somebody said, you're looking for your guy in Tracy Locke in Dallas. It's a big company. And somebody heard you talk at an advertising convention a couple years ago. They think you're hot. And so I went and talked to them and they hired me. So I got out of the Nut House, one of the best jobs of my life. And I brought my family to Dallas and went to work there. And pretty soon my drinking got bad again. Because I had to start drinking to stand it up out of the hospital. And I got called in again. And I didn't know what to do. I went to AA then. I went to the Town North group. And I'd go there in the morning on my way to work. Up to Cedar Springs is where the advertising agency was. And I'd stop in there and there'd be an old guy mopping. And I'd say, geez, I got to get through today. It was my job. And he'd give me a cup of coffee. He said, kid, you can do it. AA really works. And I said, good. And I'd go to work at about noon. I just couldn't stand it. I'd have to sneak a few beers and then drink at night and be home. Just on and on. And finally, they fired me. And it was so sad because when they fired me, they told my wife first. And so by the time I got home, after spending my severance check, she'd moved out, left a note, we can't take any more. And I never wondered if she went. Went to White Rock Lake, actually. Someplace out there. I didn't know that. And I got another little job down at an engraving company. And while I was there, they came in and repossessed my car and just went down. And I'd really been something. And I was all of a sudden, just everything I was touching was turning to crap. Just, God, got fired there finally. And I had to get out of town. I knew that I was on probation from the hospital to my wife. What they did at that time to get out of the hospital, they'd find someone responsible for you and they'd say, now you be responsible for him. If he acts badly, you call us. We'll come and get him. And I knew she must have turned me in by this time. So I had to get out of Texas. Some guy knew, said, well, I got a car. I need delivered in Los Angeles. Do you want to drive that? I said, Jesus, yes. I threw all the stuff I had into that and away I went. Got to El Paso the first night. Had a wonderful night in Juarez with my old friends. And my strength came back. The next day I got to Phoenix and got drunk there and lost the car. I haven't found it yet. All my clothes, all my ID, everything. And looking around the streets, and some guy said, "What? Stop acting so crazy." I said, "Don't shut up." It turned out he was a plainclothes cop. And he threw me in jail overnight. And I was up there, oh God, I don't think there's any air conditioning in the Phoenix jail at that time, about 130 degrees up on the third floor. And I was so sick in the middle of the night, I got up and I went over to vomit, and I thought I was vomiting in the toilet, turned out to be some guy's bunk. He wasn't in it, thank God, but I vomited. That made me feel better, and I laid down next to it, put my cool cheek on the tile, and went to sleep. And this guy came back, some trustee or something, where he went and found this drunk lady next to his bed full of vomit. He said, you dumb, drunken bastard. And I don't think he meant to do it. He kicked my front teeth out. And that was one of the few mornings I was really glad I'd been in psychoanalysis. I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything to make trouble. They let me out the next morning, covered with blood, my clothes were torn and vomit, and in Phoenix, Arizona, where I didn't know anybody, and I couldn't think of anybody who would accept to collect a phone call from me. I had really burned an awful lot of people. But there was something I'd learned in my days in AA. If any of you plan to become long-term slippers, you can use my wisdom. When you get to a point where there's no place you can go, you can always go to an AA club. Only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jim. Look at him. So I found out where the AA club was. I'm called the Arid Club. I went over there and hustled some old lady. I told her, I need $20 for a 12-step house. I have no money in it. Could you help me? Sure. And I took that and ran downtown, caught a bus to Los Angeles. And there was a guy in Los Angeles, a big star. And I'd given him his start years ago, and I called him up. I said, Jesus, Ted, I had a terrible car accident. And it's so terrible. I have nothing. I'm bleeding. He said, well, come on out to KFWB, a big station on the Hollywood Boulevard. He told me how to get out there in the bus. And I went out there, and I went to the office. God, he was shocked to see me. He said, oh, Clancy, I can't believe that's you. Unshaven, bloody, no front teeth. And he gave me a couple $100. He said, how could you? I said, thanks, Ted. God bless you. And I got a little room and drank and had fun and sang songs and ran out of money and called him up. He said, Ted, my check hasn't come yet. Could you help me? He said, no, your check. I called Dallas. Your check didn't. You have no check coming. You're a bum. Everybody in Dallas that you used to work with knows you're a bum. Don't bother me again. Oh, Jesus, Tim. Ted, I said, I'm so sick. Please, just for old times. He said, okay. You come out to the station tonight, but not in the front door. Come to the alley in the back. I'll be coming out the second floor of the fire escape at 9 o'clock, and this is the last time I'll ever want to hear from you. Oh, gee, thanks a lot, Ted. I'm out there at 8:30, so I wouldn't miss him. Stood in the rain for half an hour waiting for him to come out, and he came out. He says, you make me sick, and he threw a $5 bill that fluttered down into a puddle. And I crawled out, and I'm, thanks, Ted. And a couple days later, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission and said, stay out of here, you phony bastard. I tried to explain to him, I'm not a phony bastard. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, they were running that very week in Life and Time and serving New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for things I've done. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. You know? And I stood outside of that mission that morning, and I was dying. Probably the ultimate crisis of my life. I was dying, and I could not think of any possible solution. AA couldn't help people like me, because by this time I knew my problem wasn't alcohol, but I still drank too much because of my sickness, my neurosis. God, I don't want to even think about God. I'm going to return to God if I die first. There's no place to go. It's just raining. I said, some guy next to me, I said, where's the AA club, pal? He said, well, there's no AA club around here. You have to go to Wilshire and Fairfax. Where the hell is that? He said, well, Wilshire takes him all the way down to Los Angeles Street. You have to go up this hill to Hill Street and cross over to Wilshire and go west till you come to it. All right. Away I went. And God, I remember still vaguely remember that walking in the rain so sick and up Wilshire Boulevard and all these fancy stores and big cars in the rain, and I'm walking, walking, walking. I counted my car later. That's about 7.5 miles. That's a long walk when you're bleeding and sick. Got to this stupid old club and went in there, the same old idiot. Oh, welcome home, son. You've got a new life. Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. And I lurked around that club, and that night there was a meeting, and they had served cake, and I could eat that because so I ate about 4 pounds of their cake. I could chew that. Then they had a meeting on gratitude, and I almost puked it up. Then everybody went home, and I was the only one left. The manager was trying to close up, and if I go out in that rain, I'm going to die. What can I do? So I put on my newcomer look. I said, I'm a newcomer, and I have no place to go, and it's raining. I may die. I said, could you help me? He said, you're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn left a 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. It doesn't run, but you can sleep in that. It's dry. I said, you mean to say AA's answer is to sleep in an abandoned car? He said, good deal, huh? No, that really is a good deal. And I never guessed that I'd never drink again. I never knew I'd never drink again. And it turned out just very quickly to get to it. He gave me, the next day the manager said, you have to be a member to come in here in the daytime, but you're such a mess you'll die out there and make us look bad. You can come in the club, but you can't. Don't ask anybody for money. None of your smart remarks. You have to go to our meetings every night. I thought, oh, Jesus. I'd rather, couldn't you just flog me instead? You know, what the hell? But I went to these meetings. I just hated them. Slept that damn abandoned car every night. Ate cake. And in that meeting, I saw a man who saved my life. I didn't have no idea who. I'd seen him in the movies. He was a movie actor. And a movie star. He must be rich. I bet he'd like to have a new friend. And I moved in on him. He didn't want a new friend, turned out. But later in the week, these old fools in the club, you know, another pocket of enthusiasm, old fools, you know. Pretty good sponsor, boy. If you're going to die in that car out there in the rain, get a sponsor. So I moved in, and old Bob the actor, I so admire your program. Would you be my sponsor? I said, sure, kid. I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. And I started my life. It was over a period of time, the next few weeks and months. He saved my life, although I never do it at the time. He became my sponsor. They said he wasn't a movie star at all. He'd been in three movies as a character actor, and I'd seen two of them. So I thought he's a movie star. I've been in more movies than he ever was. Makes me tired to think about it. And they said he wasn't a good actor, but he was, because he'd come to meetings and act nice, which took a lot of acting for him to act nice, because he was turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Do this. I thought, why am I taking this crap from this guy? Because he was the only breadwinner I could get out of there. And I could see it kept raining and raining. And I thought, I remember sleeping in that car when I think, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what hell is. Maybe hell isn't fire and brimstone, like they say. Maybe it's just being sick all the time, and your mouth bleeds. And everywhere you go, people behind you can hear ridiculing you, and you can't do a thing about it. And it's going to be this way forever. God, what a terrible feeling. But what he did for me was this. One night I heard him say something even more stupid than he usually said. To somebody, maybe me or somebody else, he says, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. And I'd already told him my problem was not really alcohol. I had different reasons, but I did drink some. But I'm not there for to find the answer to my drinking problem. And he told this person, and I said, why do you tell people that? These people are alcoholics. Their problem is alcohol. They should tell me their problem isn't alcohol. He said, no, their problem isn't alcohol. If their problem is alcohol, they shouldn't be in AA. They're wasting their time and wasting our time. Oh, Jesus, Bob. A little hot under the lights last night. And he gave me a long harangue, which I won't go into, but I blotted out most of it. But it boiled down to this. He said, if your problem is alcohol, there's an answer to that. You quit drinking, and you clean up your act, and you live pretty comfortably. You don't have to do anything else about it. However, if you suffer from what I suffer from, which sounds like alcohol, but it isn't, you got no chance. I said, what is that, Bob? He said, there's something called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm awfully smart. Alcoholism. Hooray, I'm cured. I could make him crazy in about a minute, usually. He said, kid, the difference is this. If the problem is alcoholism, which unfortunately for all of us looks exactly the same as the alcohol problem, but this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. They always say stopping drinking is what makes it better. He says, no, stopping drinking makes it worse for people like us. If that's the case, why the hell do these people continue to drink? They know it's doing terrible things. He said, they're not drinking because they're doing terrible things. You don't seem to know much. He said, you know, what an alcoholic is a person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Yes, I know. It's just the phenomenon of craving. And then they drink till they go crazy. And then he said, nah, that's podium talk. He says, I'll tell you why alcoholics drink, and he had a cup of coffee in his hand. He says, just imagine this is gin. If I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly alters my perception of the world around me. When I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. When I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly makes me taller and more self-reliant inside, and them less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because it is not really happening, you moron. And he said, you may get the phenomenon of craving, you may not, but I guarantee you one thing, you'll always get sober again. You can't stay drunk. But okay, now they're sober again. They know the alcohol's eating them up. Why would they drink now? Answer me that. He said, that's the other part of it, kid. He said, you know, he explained this to me, and I heard, somebody gave me a tape I made when I was about 3 years sober a while back, and I heard me quote what he said, and I didn't ever think much about it, because it's all right. But I went 35, 40 years without quoting it, and then I started, I heard it after I got that tape, that, God, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. He said, kid, when people are born and raised, it's tough growing up. There's a lot of things you got to learn. You got to learn, you got to give to get. You got to learn to solve problems that are going to be in your way. You got to learn to deal with conflicts. Try to avoid them. If you can't avoid them, solve them. You got a lot of things to do. That whole process is called maturing. And if you become a mature individual, you can live comfortably in this world. You can hold a job. You could get along with your co-employees. You could get along with your neighbors. Go on square vacations and enjoy them. It's a good life. He said, but this doesn't happen to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because along the way, when we have problems and conflicts and we can't find a way to quickly solve them, we have learned that we can drink them away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. And it really works. But the negative, all of a sudden wrong with these things. I'm building a little trailer attached to my butt full of unsolved childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions, but they're alcoholic emotions are childish emotions. I'm building a little bundle of those. And the time comes when I want to quit, I'm going to quit, stop all this crap, go home, start working good, could do good in the job, to hell with all this, as we all do from time to time. Never once realizing it is impossible for me to do that. Because sooner or later, someone will trigger those emotions. Someone will hurt my feelings. Someone will say something bad about me. It will be obvious to me people are against me. And those emotions start to fission. When I was young, it wasn't so bad. I quit my job, punch the son of a bitch in the face and get out of there. But when you got kids and a rent to pay, you can't do that. So you deal with them. And you find ways, try to find somewhere to get even with that rotten bastard. And lie awake sometimes and think, and little by little becomes aware that his friends are always also against you. And little by little, it just starts to almost a paranoid fantasy, little by little, not even know it. It gets bad. Scientists say that people like us can get to a point where you literally must drink to preserve your sanity. Isn't that odd? And eventually you do. And then you drink, the balloon goes up. Never knew that. He said, that's why, kid, that's why people drink. I said, Jesus, Bob, I've never heard that explained before. Why doesn't AA, you know, that's the story of my life. For the last 10 or 12 years, I've had some big jobs. I've been a hotshot sometimes, and I wind up here sleeping in a damn abandoned car because I can't control my emotions sometimes, and I drink too much. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh. What could that be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, my God. If that's what an alcoholic is, that's what I am. I never heard that. Well, why doesn't AA describe it the way you do, to this phony allergy of the body and obsession of the mind, all that second-rate psychological baloney? He said, they do, kid. Look up there on the wall. You know what we ask you to do? One, admit you're having a problem drinking, which I guess you are. And then there's a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you must also admit you're having a problem without alcohol. That was in December of 1958, a long time ago. I was about 6 weeks sober. And what it did, it relieved my fear of being insane. At least I knew the name for what was wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic. And my life didn't get better. I had a terrible, seemed a terrible. But little by little, Bob would console me. And I'd talk to him sometimes. Once I go to commit suicide, he'd talk to me for an hour. And what happened is I began little by little to think, Jesus, this guy seems to know how I feel. That doesn't sound like much, does it? But I had never known a person who I thought knew how I feel. My dad didn't. My doctor didn't. My psychiatrist, they all said they did. We know how you feel. You have to say, gee, thanks. But you want to say, no, you don't. No, you don't understand at all. And what's important about having someone know how you feel? I'll tell you why. Everyone in this room, alcoholics, I suppose others too, have had enough advice to last them 10,000 years. People like us just draw advice like a magnet. Just whoom. Passers-by. Think you ought to go to rehab. And you learn how to burn them off. You say, thanks a lot. They just bounces off. But if you find somebody that knows, that you believe knows how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information and you may take actions on it as foreign as it sounds. I remember standing at the Brentwood meeting with him, and I'd been sober a few weeks, and just 6 blocks from where later O.J. Simpson didn't kill his wife. And he said, see that woman over there? I said, yes, I see her. So I want you to apologize to her. Why should I, Bob? Someone told me Monday night at the club you called her a bitch at the meeting. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. I can't think of a person in the world who told me that, that I wouldn't have said, to hell with you. Go over there and abase myself with that fat old pus bag. All she's done is badmouth me all the time I've been sober. And she'd go around all of me and say, I made him knuckle under. He's nothing. He's a quitter. I wouldn't do that for nothing. But somebody that I believed knew how I felt told me to do something I never thought I'd do.
Sorry I called you a bitch.
You a bitch. But he had me stay on jobs I was going to quit. He had me do a lot of things. And little by little, he saved my life because I could accept him as my higher power. And I accepted it as my higher power. And I couldn't return to God. When I heard talks about God, I just want to leave the room. Because by this time, I have broken all 10 commandments. And I know I'm going to go to hell no matter what. And that old son of a bitch is going to get me. But I don't have to sit and pretend to love him. And they said, need a higher power? And they said, turn your will and life over to the power greater than yourself. And I rewrote it in my mind to do what Bob said. Saved my life. And the other thing I want to say quickly, the second step, ask you to return to sanity. Some power greater than yourself can return to sanity. And what does that mean? You know, you can read 10 textbooks on mental health, you can get 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, insanity is quite easy to define. And that is, when the brain is under sufficient intense conflict, cannot be reduced or removed, it many times, in order to maintain its neural integrity, will change its perception of reality. That is called psychosis. And when you become psychotic, you usually stay that way. We say, hey, well, I was psychotic, I wasn't. But when you become psychotic, you usually stay that way. Sometimes just the whole world, sometimes just a little bit. You see the paper about a guy. I lived next door to that guy for 10 years. He came home one night, took a rifle, killed all his kids, killed his wife, killed himself. I don't know why. Something triggered a psychotic psychosis. But, you know, the psychosis. But alcoholics rarely ever don't become psychotic. And you think they would, because they say the second greatest cause of death among alcoholics is alcoholism. That's true, but not from insanity. Is that not from psychosis? Is that funny? It's something entirely different. Most of us in this room who've ever been drunk a lot know how it feels to wake up in the morning with a terrible thirst. Somebody put the fire out. Jesus Christ. Oh. Now, why would you develop a terrible thirst after drinking fluids? Because alcohol may be the only thing I ever heard of that dries out. It's the only fluid that dries out your body. It goes through your body and it dries it out. It dries out the cells it touches. It kills the cells. It's called the desiccation of cells. It kills millions of cells every time you get drunk. And later when you induce fluids, it goes through your body and they come alive again. And they die and come alive and die and come alive. There's only two organs in the body. When the cells die, they don't come alive again. Bad luck for us. One is your liver. One is your brain. That's why people like us die from liver problems. And eventually it takes a lot of drinking, but you can dry out your brain. That's called the Korsakoff syndrome. And oddly enough, that's what we call wet brain. But it's a dry brain. And most of you will never see a case of it. I see a lot of it, but I wish I didn't. But they're not wandering the streets acting crazy. They're sitting on somewhere in a hospital. And people come and change their diapers and feed them and put them to bed and get them up and feed them and change their diapers and put them to bed. This goes on. They can never get better. It's like the last stages of Alzheimer's, except Alzheimer's has the decency to kill the patient. In the Korsakoff syndrome, you could sit like that for 50 years. Your family comes down to see if mom knows them. Hi, mom, we're here to hear you. Get away from me, you son of a bitch, I don't know you. They cry and go home. Terrible thing. But why don't alcoholics become psychotic? That's a good question, isn't it? Nothing magic. It's when it gets bad enough so the brain is about to cry out for a change of perception, I will drink alcohol, which will allow me to change my perception of reality. I have the power to induce psychosis, although I never knew it. Temporary psychosis. And he said that's why alcoholics drink. They drink to reduce the pressure on their brain. Sometimes. And I, Jesus. So what I had to come to understand, these steps really mean what they say. I didn't believe there was a power greater than myself, which I chose to believe was Bob, could restore me to sanity. In other words, would it find me a way to live without having to drink to stand it? You know, there's nothing you have to know about it. You have to try to believe the concept. You have to find how it's going to come about. Then you turn your life over to that higher power as best you can, or try to do what God, Bog says. As a result of that, my life got a little better. Very slowly, when I was a year sober, I finally had held a job a month without being fired, which was a record. Had a little room in Hollywood. When I was 2 years sober, I had held a job 4 months, 4.5 months. After I was 2 years sober, I got a job as a writer in a medical corporation, a beginning writer, and I thought, I'm going to really turn it on here. And I went to work there, and they got me some clothes in the thrift shop, and I was ready to make my move because I really believed in AA. And I was there about 4 days, and I heard somebody say, that guy hasn't got any front teeth. He said, tell me, front teeth. I carried my lip like this. And I thought, Jesus, why would a guy say that? Well, I'm trying so hard. That son of a bitch is trying to make me an object of ridicule. And I decided to pop him and quit the job. But I'd promised Bob I'd call him before I quit. Bob! He told me something to do. I said, I won't work with this guy. This guy's bad news. He said, what are you doing, I tell you? So I went to this guy. I said, you know, why did you, I wanted to just punch him. I said, why did you say I didn't have any front teeth? Are you ridiculing me? He said, oh, no. He said, I was telling someone, I know she didn't have any front teeth in our meeting. And that's, I know you're coming from something that has really done treated you badly and you're trying to make a new life. And I just admire you for trying. Oh. There must have been 25 times in the first couple of years I was about to quit or run away or get drunk or something. I'd call Bob and he'd give me some stupid thing to do. By the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big corporation. Had front teeth. If any of you have lost teeth, let me give you hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. And I got into radio and television, became quite successful there. Another guy and I created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio. We were just slicker than we could be. And 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was marketing director in Beverly Hills. And my life, there was ups and downs along the way, but it always landed on my feet. I think A, it really helped me. And I discovered something along the way, what the purpose of AA was. I was not the person who had to get drier and drier. But that isn't it. You don't get so dry. 2 months, you're going to be as dry as you're ever going to be. God, if you kept getting drier, I'm sober 49 years, I'd burst into flame up here. The purpose of AA, and I believe this implicitly, and I want to say this to new people here. The purpose of AA, I believed, I bet my life on it, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality, to make it a friendly view. To change my relationship to the world around me so I'm not in a paranoid state. To little by little make me more, a little more self-confident and them less threatening to me. And it really, you can't ever sustain that wonderful feeling, but you get it more often. And everybody, every human being has bad days. We like to think, oh, I'm an alcoholic, that's why I have these bad feelings. Every human being has them. There isn't a human being in the world that doesn't have days where you know by 10 o'clock, there's no hope for this day. It's over. So what you do then, you just keep your mouth shut and just say to yourself, come on, midnight. Come on, midnight. Because there are bad days and good days, and things get better. The only trouble with AA, really, is that sometimes it makes you feel good and you're not used to feeling good, and it makes you do dumb things. When I was 15 years sober, I was doing well. I was reunited with my family, had another little boy. And I was really feeling superlative. And in some hideous fit of misjudgment, I resigned that job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 34 years, I've been the managing director of the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you give up your great career to run that mission? And there's no good answer for that. Well, such a significant decrease in salary, I didn't want to pass it up. As I often say, Monday morning, I'll do something I'm sure none of you do. I live out in the west side of Los Angeles by the ocean, nice big house. Today there are 150 A's in my backyard playing ball. I can't be there. I have to be in a snowstorm. Next week I'll be in Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm going over to the Bill Clinton Library and kick it. Anyway, we don't talk about guys. In 1963, there was a guy who spoke at the Ohio Street meeting, the Pacific Group, I just started. And he said, there are three things we don't talk about in AA. We don't talk about politics, sex, or religion, because they're too personal. But I do want to say a few words about that damn Catholic president screwing all those girls. Anyway. I started off to say something here very important too. What was it? Well, anyway. Oh yes. I live in a house out in West L.A. Could you play that back for me? My name is Clancy Ibbets, and I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to be here tonight, and I want to. And I'll get in the freeway Monday morning, my car, and I'll drive Highway 10, the Santa Monica Freeway downtown. My car still wants to get off in Beverly Hills sometime. No, we can't. We don't go there anymore. Stop it. I'll go down to this dreadful area called Skid Row, big in Los Angeles, full of not only all the bums, but illegal aliens, all sorts of dreadful people dying in there. And I'll park my car underneath the building, and I'll go take a walk around the building. And I'll step over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and abandonment and insanity, a lot of insanity. And I'll go upstairs, and then we'll all work together, try to find some ways, if we can, to get some of these poor bastards to admit their problem, to find an action they will take they don't want to take, and little by little bring them along. And it's a terrible job. Try to do it difficult. And then I'll go home at night, and I'll eat dinner at my house, and I'll go to a meeting and listen to somebody complain about they had a bad time because they had somebody look funny at them at the Burke today and feel just as bad to them. And it's a remarkable thing. I think sometimes, what the hell am I doing all this for? I should be on top somewhere. I'm doing good. I should be president or something. But really, I got a more impressive gift. I think about this very often. It's the same gift that every alcoholic in this room has, and we don't even know we have it. Because it's so come so without even being aware of it. And the gift is this. It's a gift no one else in the world has. No doctor, no psychiatrist, no clergyman, no nothing. The gift you and I have been given is this. The power to talk to another alcoholic. To help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that happens, that is the beginning of sobriety, and that's the birth of God's life. Thank you.